Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the shaky ceasefire in Ukraine and the fragile peace that is expected to be temporary. Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer joins us. A former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, he was a special assistant to the president and senior director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council, and is now the director of the Brookings Institution's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russia issues. We will discuss Ukraine's precarious military and financial situation and what might restrain Vladimir Putin in his determination to crush the new government in Kiev. Then we'll examine the mess in Libya, where there has been chaos since the US and NATO liberation of the country from the long and brutal Gaddafi dictatorship. Wayne White, a scholar at the Middle East Institute, who was deputy director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research and served as a State Department intelligence analyst on Libya, joins us to discuss the impact of the Egyptian bombing of Islamic State fighters in retaliation for the graphic executions of Coptic Christian workers, and Libya's oil-dependent economy that has all but ground to a halt from raids by the various militias on oil terminals and ports. Then finally, following the meeting in Budapest between the Russian and Hungarian leaders, we will look into Putin's unusual alliance with Hungary's Prime Minister Orbán and Putin's funding of neo-Nazi and fascist parties in Western Europe. Kim Lane Shepelet, a professor of sociology at Princeton University who lived in Budapest and Russia for extended periods, joins us to discuss the odd man out in Europe as Hungary drifts to the right and the demonstrations against Putin that took place with banners reading, "Putin no, Europe yes." And joining us now is Stephen Pfeiffer, who is the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russia issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to Kiev, he has had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Pfeiffer.
Thank you for having me.
And this ceasefire that was negotiated between the French, German, Ukrainian, and Russian leaders seems to be a bit of a joke in terms of what's happening, and a pretty grim joke at that, in terms of this one particular flashpoint that continues to be fought over. And I take it what's happening here is that the Ukrainian army is pretty much surrounded, and if they lose this town that both sides are fighting over, it could be a significant blow. And there's no, and of course, at this point, the so-called rebels are saying that they've already, they're claiming victory. So do we know where this stands and what the consequences will be?
Well, I mean, we're talking about the fighting that's taking place around the town of Debaltseve, which is a fairly strategic railway junction between the cities of Donetsk and Luhansk. And you've seen confusing reports over the course of the day. The rebels say that they've either occupied the town or encircled it. The Ukrainians maintain that they still have communications lines through to the town. But I think the broader point is, you know, the ceasefire supposedly was to begin at midnight on Saturday night. The fighting around Debaltseve that was, in fact, escalating right before the ceasefire simply continued. And you have evidence now, it's not just separatist forces, but there are now, you know, I think compelling evidence that there are Russian tanks, Russian artillery participating in the assault. And you had this sort of strange statement by separatist leaders a couple of days ago. They said, well, the ceasefire didn't apply to Debaltseve.
Well, but what's at stake, though, Ambassador Pfeiffer? Isn't it, would a defeat for the Ukrainians, and particularly the capture of, 6,000 soldiers, that would be a huge blow, would it not?
Well, certainly, I think the loss of that, if in fact that's going to happen, would be a major loss. But it's also not just the military loss. I mean, that's going to be a huge setback for an agreement that was concluded last Thursday that everyone saw as fragile. But if the ceasefire immediately breaks down, what are the prospects that the other elements of the agreement can be made to hold? It's a very disturbing in development for those who would like to see some measure of peace and normalcy be restored to Ukraine.
So Ukraine itself, though, of course, is probably one of the most fragile states in the world, is it not? We focus a lot on Greece's economic problems, but they pale in comparison to Ukraine's.
Ukraine is in a very difficult financial situation, and my guess is one of the reasons that Ukrainian President Poroshenko accepted the agreement that was negotiated last Thursday, which in many ways is not to Ukraine's advantage, is he accepted it because he does need some breathing space to address the compelling and the very difficult financial and economic problems he faces. But again, based on what we've seen in the last several days, it's not clear that he's going to get that breathing space.
I spoke recently with the independent defense analyst in Moscow, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who writes for Novaya Gazeta, which is about the only newspaper that Putin doesn't control. And he was saying that the West simply doesn't get the fact that Putin will not lose Ukraine the way he sees it, that he's just not going to give up. He's not going to live with this government that we have now.
Well, if that in fact is the case, then that does not bode well for the ceasefire or for the agreement. The problem I think that Mr. Putin faces is there is, I think, a fairly determined government on the other side, and while militarily weak compared to Russia, I think they are determined to resist. I mean, one of the reasons why I guess that the Russians and the separatists have not tried to expand their control further is they're now probably at the point where the more territory that they control, if they move far beyond the borders of what they hold now, they may well find that the population is not sympathetic and they may be facing aspects of partisan warfare.
Well, that's in a way one of the arguments I believe that the Europeans have. Would you agree, Ambassador Pfeiffer, that there's a difference in the European and American approach to Ukraine, that the Europeans tend to see the situation there as akin to the beginning of World War One, where, you know, a small conflict can blow up into a global war, whereas on the U.S. side, we see things, we use the analogy of Munich and selling out the Czechs in 1938.
There may be something of that, but my impression is that, in fact, the Europeans are coming to a more realistic assessment of Russia. And I think you've seen that in Chancellor Merkel, who is at both hands, I think, a realist about the difficult situation that Ukraine faces, but has also been very adamant about principle, particularly the principle that you don't use military force to take territory from other countries and redraw borders. So you have seen, I think, a fairly unified stand between the United States and Europe on the question of maintaining sanctions. And my guess is that if this ceasefire breaks down, as it appears to be doing, with the responsibility lying principally with the separatists and the Russians, there may well be a push for additional sanctions.
Well, of course, there was a phone conversation yesterday between Angela Merkel, I think Poroshenko, and Putin to try and, you know, hold this ceasefire together. And the OSCE is apparently going to come bring monitors in. But in general, though, when you mentioned the idea that that the Russians could overreach and then end up with partisan warfare, that seems to me to be one of the things that the Europeans are arguing, is that, you know, we can't really stop Putin because he has so much more military power and he's located right there on the border. But if he bites off more than he can chew, then eventually, just like the Soviet Union fell, Novaya Russia, Putin's imperialist aims, will also eventually fall. Because I think by implication that means that a lot of people are going to suffer in the meantime. But what do you think of that scenario?
Well, no, I mean, this is what I worry, is that the conflict will continue. It's going to be mean more death and suffering for Ukrainians. Part of the problem here, though, is it's not yet clear that the Russians are prepared to accept a settlement on terms that would be reasonable, on any kind of terms that the government in Kyiv could accept. I mean, most analysts, I think, when they looked at the agreement that was concluded last Thursday, considered it a victory for the Russians. Yet the Russians poured additional units into the assault on Debaltseve. I mean, the State Department on the weekend pointed out Russian artillery shelling Debaltseve. And there was even posted a couple of days ago a piece by a correspondent who's widely seen as pro-separatist. And as he's talking in the background, and he says, "I'm near Debaltseve," there are clearly Russian tanks, and you can tell by the configuration of the armor that they are Russian tanks in the background. So it doesn't appear to be that this agreement, which people saw as favoring Russia, is acceptable to Mr. Putin if the separatists and the Russians are continuing the conflict.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Pfeiffer, who's the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine and Russia. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to Kiev, he's had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. Just, I think it was yesterday, in the UK, the former head of British Foreign Intelligence Service, MI6, Sir John Sawyers, warned that the crisis in Ukraine was no longer about Ukraine. He went on to say it's much bigger and more dangerous, and that any attempt by Western countries to arm Ukraine could lead to an escalation on the ground and even cyber attacks by Russia against the West. So what's your sense of where we stand and how much worse it could get? And in general, the whole idea, and people like Henry Kissinger have said that the U.S. has not taken into account Russia's security needs, and many argue that if Russia or China were to make security arrangements with Canada or Mexico, we'd go crazy. After all, we do have the Monroe Doctrine.
Yeah. Well, let's be clear on a couple of things. I mean, even though it was not reflected specifically in the agreement's terms that were signed on Thursday, the Russian concerns about Ukraine drawing too close to NATO have been answered. President Hollande made very clear a week and a half ago that he would not support Ukraine drawing closer to NATO. Chancellor Merkel, although she talks about it less, also does not favor that. There is no enthusiasm within NATO for putting Ukraine on a membership track. So to the extent that that was a Russian concern, that's been answered. And President Putin had ample opportunity to talk to both Chancellor Merkel and President Hollande about that. So it seems to be more than this question. And it really, again, gets to, is Russia prepared to allow, what vestige of sovereignty is Russia prepared to allow to Ukraine? If you go back 6 months ago, 7 or 8 months ago, President Poroshenko was saying, we're prepared to take NATO off the table. The Russians never picked up on that. So I'm not sure that this so-called threat from NATO is a factor in Russia, as it's sometimes described, or if it is, it's a factor that they've had an opportunity to defuse, but Moscow has chosen not to do that. I'd also like, though, on the comment about escalation, and I agree there is some risk on the Russians escalating, but I think people who say, well, the Russians will escalate, may assume that escalation is too easy or easier than, in fact, would be the case for the Kremlin. Because escalation beyond the current situation almost certainly involves more overt involvement by the Russian army in eastern Ukraine. And the Kremlin may choose to do that. But that comes with risks and costs for the Kremlin, because that more overt involvement then becomes visible to the Russian public, who will see that involvement and will also see greater Russian casualties. And polls show that the Russian public does not want the Russian army fighting in Ukraine, which is one of the reasons why the Kremlin has gone to extraordinary lengths to hide that fact from the Russian people. But it also, more overt involvement by the Russian military becomes visible to the outside world, and that's only going to increase the likelihood of stiffer sanctions from the West. So Russia may well escalate, but it's something that Russia does. They're going to have to calculate that there will be real cost to that.
Well, so far, Putin has not paid any price, it would seem, for the outrageous shooting down of a passenger airliner. He's riding high at home. There has to be some support in Russia, some psychological support, if you will, for this idea of reasserting Russia and getting over the humiliation of the loss of empire. There must be a collective sense of humiliations that the Russians have, because I talk to people who go to Russia and you know, it's very sad for the intelligentsia and the entrepreneurs, etc. They've all basically, they're trying to get out of the country. The hundreds of thousands of people who protested against Putin when he decided to take a third term, they're basically being squeezed out of existence, because it is a gangster state and Putin is the head of the mafia. But he's incredibly popular. And it's delusional, but the Russian people seem to feel that he's their leader and they're proud of him.
Well, there's a couple of things to take into account. I don't dispute Putin has a very high level of approval among the Russian public. But to one extent, you know, it's been built because the Kremlin controls all the major levers of broadcast media in Russia. So it's an image and it's a popularity that has been shaped very directly by the Kremlin. But I guess I would toss in a couple of other points. One is, as I said, polls consistently show that the Russian population does not want to see the Russian army fighting in Ukraine. The Russian government has gone to extraordinary lengths to hide that fact from their own people, including disgraceful things such as burying troops at night. I've heard reports of people who were wounded fighting in the Russian army in Ukraine being told that if they disclosed where they lost their leg, then they would lose their disability pensions. That sort of thing, which suggests to me that the Kremlin is very nervous that if the public begins to see the fact that the Russian army is fighting in Ukraine, they're concerned that that will erode public support for Putin. A second factor here goes to the economic sanctions, which have inflicted a significant amount of damage on the Russian economy, particularly in conjunction with the fall in the price of oil, although those economic sanctions have not yet achieved their political goal, which is to effect a change in Russia's approach towards eastern Ukraine. But those sanctions will continue to have impact, and that impact is going to build. By some estimate, the average Russian is going to see his purchasing power decline by 10 to 20% over the next year. Does that have an impact on Russian popular support for Mr. Putin? So I think there are things here that play out. And Mr. Putin seems to care very much about his approval rating. If he begins to see that erode, will he adjust course?
So in other words, there's not a lot the West can do, because so far he's pretty defiant in the face of sanctions. But if casualties continue, then that might undermine his influence.
I think the continued impact of the economic sanctions, and as the Russian population begins to understand the extent that the Russian army is involved in Ukraine and the costs that are being paid by the Russian army, I think those things will weaken support for him. We'll have to see. And to some extent, this is a bit of a game back and forth, where I think Mr. Putin's hope is that support for the sanctions in the West will decline and that he can basically evade the longer-term impact of the sanctions while still being able to pursue his policy in Ukraine. I would argue that it's very important that the West make absolutely clear to the Russians that the sanctions stay on and that indeed the sanctions will become tougher unless there is an adjustment in Russian policy towards Ukraine. Without that, we may find that Mr. Putin tries to outweigh the West.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Stephen Pfeiffer.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pfeiffer, who's the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russia. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to Kiev, he had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the mess in Libya. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Wayne White, who's a scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle East countries, including Libya, Iran, and Iraq. He is a policy expert at the Middle East Policy Council and was an expert advisor with the Iraq Study Group. And he previously served as Deputy Director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia, and the State Department's representative to NATO Middle East Working Groups. And he also served as a State Department Intelligence Analyst on Libya. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wayne White.
My pleasure.
And Wayne, this deliberately gruesome and graphic slaughter of, I think it was 25 Coptic Christian low-wage workers against the Mediterranean, marched along a beach by the seashore and ritually had their throats slit by the Islamic State until the ocean ran red with blood. And then the invocation on the video that was highly produced, like all of their pornographic murderous films are, invoked the idea that we're coming after Rome, those of the cross, the people of the cross, and infidels in Christians in Egypt, meaning the Copts. So again, they're punching it way above their weight, but we have a tendency in the West to take their bait, don't we?
There is, yes, and particularly to rerun and give them a lot of publicity on this. The irony of this is that they've self-designated themselves as the quote-unquote Islamic State. And in Islam, it is absolutely forbidden to kill prisoners. It is absolutely forbidden to attack Christians. Many people don't know it. Many listeners probably don't know it. But Jews and Christians under Islam are considered peoples of the book and peoples who worship the same God, essentially, is that's the way of saying it, as do Muslims. Yahweh, Allah, and that gave them a special status of protection within all of the, in fact, early caliphates, the largest Islamic empire. So they're defying Islam's very principles by doing this. If anything, they should be called the un-Islamic state.
So why then? I mean, I guess one of the problems is that as you create failed states, which the invasion of Iraq did, and the so-called liberation of Libya did, then these parasites fill the vacuum. That seems to be what's happening here.
Exactly. And in this instance, Libya is not really a center of Islamic State activity. There have been just little dribs and drabs that have been appearing there. The most dangerous extremist group in Libya is the group that attacked our embassy. Our consulate in Benghazi back in 2012, and that's Ansar al-Sharia in Libya, which is affiliated with al-Qaeda, not the Islamic State, and hasn't even taken any opportunity to grab at the Islamic State. It has, however, been suffering some very severe defeats in Benghazi. It's lost 90% of Benghazi to the forces of the recognized international government in Libya, which is seated in Tobruk in the east. It is also rejected by the pretender Islamist government in Tripoli, even though they are more moderate, far more moderate than either of these groups. It was notable, however, that the government in Tripoli, the moderate Islamist government that's been battling the Eastern elected government, also denounced the airstrikes. But that's because the Egyptians have been hitting them as well in past strikes spanning back into last year.
So this is a very confusing mosaic, isn't it?
And to say the least.
And then on top of that, I think you have to add, surely, Wayne White, that this is a country who's almost entirely dependent upon oil exports, and there are virtually no exports. So this is a country rapidly going broke.
Right. It's burning through its reserves. It may only have about 5 or 6 months of reserves left, and there have been repeated attempts to try to bring these two governments together to form some government of national unity. And actually, they got them at the same table just recently, about 10 days ago. And what is needed, and I have been trying, as you know, to urge for the past year, is for the international community to increase the profile of these talks, increase the power behind these talks. They have left talks merely to the lonely UN envoy to Libya, Mr. Leon. What we really needed in Geneva were talks where you'd bring foreign ministers of the European countries together that had formed the original alliance to overthrow Gaddafi and bring a lot of pressure and some incentives to bear on these two sides to get them to get together.
And again, I'm speaking with Wayne White, who is a scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle Eastern countries, including Libya, Iran, and Iraq. He is a policy expert at the Middle East Policy Council and was an expert advisor with the Iraq Study Group. He previously served as Deputy Director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia and the State Department's representative to NATO Middle East Working Groups. And he also served as a State Department Intelligence Analyst on Libya. So what's the problem then with the U.S. is not paying attention? Is it because, you know, there was this so-called liberation, almost like a drive-by liberation of the country with NATO air power, a terrible...
That's very good.
then this horrible, obnoxious, egotistical, murderous maniac, Gaddafi, get rid of him, and then the place falls apart. And then, of course, the Republicans, as you know, have made a big deal out of Benghazi, and there's obviously no there after endless inquiries. So it seems to have become a kind of political whipping boy, and nobody seems to want to pay attention to the real issues. And frankly, when you look at what replaces the despots like Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi, it makes you wonder whether, you know, it's out of the frying pan into the fire. You know, it makes, it's almost, it becomes an excuse for despots.
It does, and in a sense, people who lived under either of those two wouldn't probably agree even now. But the tragedy in Libya, even more so than Iraq, which has problems of a different sort, they're ethno-sectarian. Libya has almost no ethno-sectarian differences. It's a Sunni Arab country, has Berber minorities, but they're very small in number. The main problem in Libya is that Libya has never really been a country. It was under colonial occupation all the way up through World War II. It has two regions, the east and the west, which now are cleaved once again into two regions, if not a third, which is the Saharan areas to the south. And under the old king before Gaddafi, it never really was unified. He allowed the regions to have a lot of decentralized power. And Gaddafi, to stay in power, essentially played the regions and tribes against each other, which damaged national unity, but kept him on top of the heap. And Gaddafi, if anything, did everything he could to disrupt political development and societal development, so that civil society is probably weaker in Libya than it is in perhaps any other Arab country, with the exception of maybe Yemen. He left it a shambles in terms of modernity and governance.
So when you hear reports now from Italy, clearly the video produced by the so-called Islamic State slaughtering the Coptic Christian workers by the seashore and making this pronouncement about going after Rome, it was clearly directed at Europe and perhaps at Italy itself. And there's been a response in Italy. And there's even talk of the Italians getting involved militarily. My understanding is that's exactly the same strategy that the Islamic State has by burning alive the Jordanian pilot, by decapitating the American journalists, is they want to attract Western boots on the ground, don't they?
Absolutely, because they can secure targets. But I'm wondering also in this case, Ian, if they weren't trying to firmly stake out themselves as perhaps a successor to Ansar al-Sharia in Libya, as a rival to the much larger and much beefier Al-Qaeda group, which is, of course, right now being battered. They may also see an opportunity to take over turf from that other Islamic radical group. This could be also part of the dynamic, because Islamic State in Libya is not strong. It has a few pinpointed locations, and the Egyptians hit the one area where they had some gravitas, and that was Derna in the east. But believe me, Derna is not a very big city. It is not a huge center of power, not like, say, Aleppo in Syria or Baghdad in Iraq or Fallujah. It's a rather small place.
Well, what do we know about Egyptian targeting there, Wayne White? I mean, do we know what they bombed?
The situation inside of Libya is so murky, it's hard for anyone to gain intelligence on what to bomb. The Egyptians don't have a lot of reconnaissance capabilities akin to ours, you know, with drones and whatnot. They have been closely aligned with the secular, internationally recognized Eastern government, which was elected in June but then rejected by Islamists because it was more secular. And they have already bombed the Islamist government in Tripoli, the rival Islamist government, and they've already bombed Al-Qaeda, the Al-Qaeda affiliate, Ansar al-Sharia. And so this is just an extension of what the Egyptians have been doing all along. In fact, at one point, the Egyptians even allowed UAE aircraft, the UAE is also concerned about radicalism in Libya, to stage through Egypt to bomb targets there. So they were probably getting their instructions, their targeting information, from the Libyan Eastern government, which is all over that area with its various allied militias and pieces of the army.
But in terms of, not that there's any point in choosing between these factions, because none of them seem to be sufficiently strong to take over the country, and the country itself is an artificial country. So, but assuming that the more secular government, which is now, you say, centered in Tobruk, what would the chances be of building that up?
I think alone, not that great. This is why it lost control of the capital of Tripoli. It lost it pretty calamitously and quickly. It's not strong. The Libyan army that is largely loyal to it, various parts of the Libyan armed forces, they're tiny because the army that Gaddafi had made was third rate anyway, and it sort of basically collapsed. Militias. There are a couple militias in the country, one affiliated with the Islamist government in Tripoli, that are bigger than the army. And so what is really needed is for the secular government and the more moderate Islamist government, which even if it condemned the attack, even if it condemned the Egyptian air attacks, does condemn the Islamic State, has genuinely condemned the Al-Qaeda affiliate, Ansar al-Sharia, and these two need to come together to at least provide some framework with which to work across the entire north of the country.
But you said that there's only a junior UN official that's trying to broker this deal that needs to be done.
Relatively junior, exactly. Even the Secretary General has not gotten directly involved in all of this. And one of the reasons that, for example, the great powers, as well as the UN, haven't been involved in all this is the distraction of all these other crises. We've got the huge crisis in Syria, which then ballooned into a crisis in Iraq, as well as Syria, which is vastly more damaging and involves far more refugees and whatnot than the one in Libya. And then we have to keep in mind that then beyond that, we have the Ukraine crisis, which is galvanizing the EU and NATO. And so these things just keep kicking Libya to the back burner. But as I argued in a recent piece, if you keep something simmering on the back burner that's very troublesome, like Libya, too long, it has a way of working to the front of the burner on its own. And this is what's happening now. More and more of this radicalization is occurring.
Well, presumably because of, some people are arguing that the Islamic State, its last hideous television production of the burning alive of the Jordanian pilot backfired. And rather than make King Abdullah look weak and unable to rescue his own pilot, it seemed to galvanize the Jordanian people in wanting revenge. So is it possible that you'd have a similar miscalculation on the part of the Islamic State in Libya, that
Yes. This
could, backfire, and that now that the Italians have seemed to be upset about it and they're the former colonial power there, could there be greater efforts to bring these two factions together and save this country from disintegration?
The possibility is really there, because Libyans are largely secular in their parliamentary elections since the Gaddafi era. They only elected one moderately, just barely, about 55% Islamist assembly. The constitution is not Islamist. The last assembly elected in June is secular, although the vote count was down by percentage. But yes, that could very well happen. In fact, I anticipate right now that one party that's probably very upset about what just happened is Ansar al-Sharia in Libya, because that extremist group, which is already almost on the ropes, could find itself cashiered in Benghazi as more militias and more people rush to the colors of the secular government in the east to smash it down as another extremist group. Similarly, you could see throughout Libya less tolerance or less passivity toward any extremist cells around. If I would be worried, I would be worried if I was a member of the Islamist government in Tripoli. It could hurt them beyond the Egyptian strikes that they objected to, because it could help the secular government. So negotiations could be opportune right now, because they might be much more in a talking mood than they were before, just in order to evade punishment or retaliation as part of an Islamist cabal, presumably connected with this extremist group, which they are not, but hard for them to separate themselves at this particular time.
But getting them to stop fighting each other and to form a unity government, that's just the first step of an obviously difficult road ahead to put a country back together.
Yes, because we talk about the government in the east and the government in the west. We're only talking about one division in Libya. We've got regional divisions. We've got dozens of towns throughout the country in various regions that are under their own militias still, even within, say, 50 miles of the capital, Tripoli. And so, yes, there's a welter of people who need to be brought to the table. And that was something that the UN representative was embarking on, even for this week. And that was not only bringing the two governments to the table, but bringing some of the largest militias to the table as well, to try to sort some of that out. In other words, getting more three-dimensional, about dealing with the problem. But he needs the firepower of a much higher profile and international attention on his talks, or they could just keep spinning out.
Well, Wayne White, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Wayne White, who's a scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle Eastern countries, including Libya, Iran, and Iraq. He's a policy expert at the Middle East Policy Council and was an expert advisor with the Iraq Study Group. He previously served as Deputy Director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia, the State Department's representative to NATO Middle East Working Groups, and he also served as a State Department intelligence analyst on Libya. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the unusual alliance between the leaders of Russia and Hungary. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kim Lane Shepperly, who is a professor of sociology and international affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School and the University Center for Human Values, as well as director of the program in law and public affairs at Princeton University. From 1994 to 1998, she lived in Budapest doing research at the Constitutional Court of Hungary and teaching at both the University of Budapest and at the Central European University, where she was the founding director of the program in gender and culture. After 1989, Shepperly studied the emergence of constitutional law in Hungary and Russia, living in both places for extended periods. Her latest book is The International State of Emergency, The Rise of Global Security Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kim Lane Shepperly.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
And there are substantial demonstrations in Hungary against the visit by the Russian President Vladimir Putin, meeting with Prime Minister Viktor Orban. And obviously, Hungary wants to negotiate a new agreement for Russian gas supplies, but Putin has largely been shunned by EU members. So why is Hungary the odd man out here in Europe in terms of, even though Orban was elected as an anti-communist and anti-Soviet, if you will, why is he playing footsie with Putin?
Well, you've put your finger on one of the main contradictions of the government of Viktor Orban in Hungary. So you're right to note that when Orban ran, both in 2010 and in 2014, he ran on this anti-communist platform. And in Russia, communism is associated with, of course, the Soviet Union, which dominated them for 50 years, but also now subsequently with Russia. So there are lots of Hungarians who have this kind of visceral reaction against Russia that usually comes with this kind of visceral anti-communism. But, of course, in Orban's first term, he ran into a lot of financial difficulties. The Hungarian budget was unsustainable. They had taken, the government of Hungary had taken out a loan with the IMF and the ECB. Those loans, by the way, from the IMF, come with requirements that the country has to meet requirements of democracy and the rule of law, both requirements that Mr. Orban has been violating with the way he's been running his government. So Orban, in his first term, paid off the IMF loan, has shunned all funding from sources that would require any kind of internal reform in Hungary. And instead, he's been looking for funding from sources that will not require him to be a Democrat. So this has led him, among other things, to Russia's doorstep, because until recently, Russia has been a big source of cash for governments that don't intend to follow the kind of structural adjustment requirements of the IMF. So that's what brought them together. Now, of course, Russia's fallen into some hard financial times now. Not so clear that Russia can continue to foot the bill for a lot of anti-democratic movements in Europe and elsewhere, but that's what ultimately brought them together.
Well, when you say Russia's been funding anti-democratic movements in Western Europe, they've been funding right-wing neo-fascist parties, the Le Pen's party in France and Orban's, and some of them parties to the right of him, my understanding is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, in Hungary, Russia is at least rumored to be one of the main funders of Jobbik, which is the really far-right party to the right of Mr. Orban's party. And by the way, Orban's party, which is called Fidesz, is often described as center-right, but it's only described as center-right because there's this neo-fascist party to the right of him. If you had Orban's party on its own anywhere else in Europe, it would look like a pretty right-wing party. So certainly, I don't know this from my own firsthand research, but there's been a lot of investigative reporting digging that shows that Russian funds are behind a lot of these kind of neo-fascist movements that are springing up all over Europe. Which is really interesting because at home, Putin doesn't tolerate or fund such things. So, you know, Putin's brand of nationalism at home has been very much what we might think of as a tolerant nationalism. You know, he doesn't pit ethnic groups against each other. Remember, Putin's the guy who, you know, put a kosher kitchen in the Kremlin. So whenever he was welcoming visitors who kept kosher, he could have state dinners for them, for example, from the Israeli prime minister. So, Putin has shown in his own domestic governance at home absolutely no far-right intolerant tendencies of that kind. And there are plenty of such movements in Russia, and he's not supported them at home. So it's interesting that he supports them abroad, and that I think he does not support them for ideological reasons. I think he's supporting them because any division in Europe is a boon to him. You know, the more united Europe is, the more determined Europe is to promote a single set of values, the more you can imagine Europe would pose a challenge to his, shall we say, anti-democratic tendencies. So it's an odd policy. Again, Putin at home is different from Putin abroad here.
And again, I'm speaking with Kim Lame Chapley, who is a professor of sociology and international affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School and the University Center for Human Values, as well as director of the program in law and public affairs at Princeton University. She lived in Budapest doing research at the Constitutional Court of Hungary, and her latest book is The International State of Emergency, The Rise of Global Security Law. So given that Europe itself is, you know, the French president not so long ago said that Europe was poised for a possible full-scale war because the situation in the Ukraine is so dicey. What's the Hungarian position vis-a-vis that? I mean, it's pretty hard to believe that they're embracing Putin, who is clearly the one who's destabilizing Ukraine. And
well, you know, Hungary. So actually, in this sense, Hungary is much more on Russia's side than you would imagine. So there is a substantial group of ethnic Hungarians in western Ukraine. And one of the concerns when this, when Poroshenko's government, but particularly the interim government that was put in place last year after the abdication of the former prime minister, the interim government clearly was a nationalist government that sort of thought that Ukraine was for Ukrainians, by which they meant not people identified with Russia, and ironically, they also meant not Ukrainians identified with Hungary. So in the very early days of the Ukrainian crisis, Orban was making these noises that maybe Hungary should reattach the parts of Ukraine that had all these Hungarians in them. In other words, the exact same policy that Putin was promoting in eastern Ukraine. Now, that didn't get very much attention because Orban was told pretty quickly by his EU buddies that he should stop making such noises, and he wisely did. But there has been some investigative reporting in Hungary that shows that there was a consulate set up in this Hungarian-speaking region of Ukraine, passing out dual citizenship to the Hungarians living there. So you know, there is this. And Orban's, the right-wing, sort of the right part of Orban's right-wing party, has been very much in favor of restoring what they call Greater Hungary, which are the boundaries of the Hungarian state before the First World War, which includes, for example, this part of Ukraine. It includes Transylvania. It includes much of Slovakia. You know, I mean, no one thinks that Hungary can withdraw the borders of Europe to restore Greater Hungary. But this little piece of Ukraine, when the country was falling apart and it might have fallen off and been picked up by Hungary, there was a moment when it actually looked like the Orban government might try to make a grab for it.
Well, but Orban's barely taking care of Hungary itself, isn't he? I mean, doesn't he have enormous problems? He's been very unpopular with the Europeans for overreach with the judiciary, with the treatment of minorities. They've been, you know, the Roma have been beaten up. I mean, he's pretty much the odd man out with the Europeans. They're very skeptical of his democratic credentials.
Well, it's true. And, you know, especially after the election last April, in which Orban was reelected, getting two-thirds of the seats in the parliament, which Orban portrayed as a landslide, that, you know, he's been losing electoral support at home. And he won the election last April through a series of electoral tricks, and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe's, their election monitoring body, said the election was not fair. And they pointed to a whole series of election law violations that benefited Orban. Now, one of those things that benefited Orban is that his government decided to give citizenship to the ethnic Hungarians in the neighboring states as part of this effort to kind of reunify historic Hungary. So they won't draw the borders, but they do want all those citizens over the borders to have voting rights in Hungary. And it was that block of new citizens in the neighboring states, particularly the group from Romania, that population voted 98% for Orban. And if he hadn't gotten all those votes from the near abroad of Hungary, he would not have gotten his two-thirds majority in the parliament. So that was a big part of the secret to his electoral success. So the problem was that Hungary couldn't really trawl for votes in Ukraine because Ukraine has a law that bans dual citizenship. Now, Ukraine obviously put that in place to ban dual Russian-Ukrainian citizenship. But there was a period after the interim government came in when the Constitution was suspended, and with it, the constitutional ban on dual citizenship. And it was during that window, both that I think Russia came in and handed out a lot of Russian passports to folks in eastern Ukraine, but also the Hungarians ran into the West and gave a lot of passports to the ethnic Hungarians in western Ukraine. So now all those people can vote for Orban because he's their savior, right? So, you know, Orban is a very clever guy. And, you know, in this regard, I think what he's picked up from the Ukrainian crisis is simultaneously, you know, street cred or, you know, a lot of credibility with the far right of his party and of Jobbik, this neo-Nazi party. And also he's gained all these new voters who will be eternally grateful that he's given them a Hungarian and therefore an EU passport. Right? I mean, you know, when you give a Hungarian passport to somebody in Ukraine, suddenly the entire EU is open for them to travel in. And, you know, they handed out a lot of those passports last spring.
So what's happening with Putin there? What's his strategy here? Wasn't there a leaked phone conversation that he had with the Ukrainian leader Poroshenko, where Putin boasted that he had a bunch of European, Western European countries in his pocket?
Yeah, so this is actually really interesting. So, you know, first of all, the source of the leak, you know, is probably the Poroshenko government. We don't know. But, yeah, there was allegedly a phone conversation between Poroshenko and Putin back in the summer when Putin basically said to Poroshenko, you know, don't count on the EU riding to your rescue. I've got a number of EU countries in my pocket, by which he meant he'd sort of bought their loyalties. And lead among those is Hungary. The others are probably Cyprus and Bulgaria, and at least some say that the Czech Republic or possibly Slovakia. So,
and you'd have to add Greece to that now because Syriza is reaching out to Putin.
Absolutely. So, you know, so it's clear that one of the things that Putin has been doing is trying to destabilize the blocks of countries that might be opposed to his policies. I mean, it's a very rational strategy, I suppose, but certainly in Hungary's case, he managed to win the loyalties. I mean, my guess, you know, just this is just a guess. It's not based on primary research, but, you know, Orban was hurting financially. He needed money. He needed money that didn't come with strings attached for him to be a Democrat. Putin goes in, suddenly makes this deal with Hungary, mostly to renovate and add to a number of power plants that the Soviet Union had built in Hungary during the Soviet time and that now Russia can update and expand. And that money coming in from that deal has been one of the things that's kept Orban afloat. So the question is what Putin gets from it. And this, again, my guess is that he gets Orban saying, well, within the EU, Orban will take Russia's side. And, in fact, Orban has done that on a number of occasions. I mean, Orban's been one of the leading critics of the sanctions against Russia that followed from the annexation of Crimea and the stirring up of trouble in eastern Ukraine. You know, at first, Orban wasn't going to go along with the sanctions. Then he was kind of forced into it, but he said the sanctions are counterproductive and they hurt us more than they hurt them. He's been a, you know, reliable critic of these sanctions. And, you know, he certainly has been someone who has made it harder for the EU to get consensus on policy against Russia. So, you know, this might be a sensible investment for Mr. Putin to make.
Well, just in closing, though, Kim Lane Chapelet, it also maybe he backed the wrong horse here because, you know, I think Putin has definitely got the upper hand with Ukraine. Obviously, he's got the military power and the West is divided and uncertain. The Europeans see it as a what they're afraid of is a replay of World War One, and what the Americans see is that this is appeasement going back to Munich mm-hmm. in 1938. So, you know, there's a different approach going on here. But at the same time, I think the long-term prognosis for Putin is not great. Certainly.
Well, you know, I wouldn't underestimate him because he's very clever. He's got massive popularity at home, which gives him a lot of room for maneuver. And he's, you know, he's refitted the Russian army. And, you know, we should not forget this is a country with nuclear weapons. I mean, I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to sound like a lunatic here. But, you know, if the U.S. decides to go in there arming the Ukrainians, who cannot possibly win? I mean, they don't know how to use these arms. They can't absorb them. They are a very weak, disorganized army in a country that's got budget deficits that make Greece look positively, you know, affluent. I mean, it's a country, Ukraine is a country that would take a massive investment to save. And the West isn't going to make that investment. And I think if the U.S. goes in there and arms Ukraine and accelerates the fighting, that we really may be seeing, you know, this kind of weird, weird effort to kind of construct World War III here. I think this is, I don't think we should underestimate Putin's determination to keep a sphere of influence around Russia. I think the U.S. would do the same if the Russians had a big toehold in Mexico, for example. I mean, I don't think it's a crazy thing for Putin to claim, and I think as long as the U.S. doesn't realize his determination and the resources he can bring to bear on that, I think it's very dangerous for Europe and for the U.S. to go in and escalate the Ukrainian crisis. So, you know, this is one of the most serious flashpoints in the world today, and I'm a little concerned that people are treating it like, you know, the powerful West is fighting second-rate powers here. I think that's really a mistake. So I hope you'll devote some more time to Ukraine in the future. I think its dangers have not been sufficiently appreciated.
Indeed. I couldn't agree with you more, and I certainly will do that. And I thank you for joining us, Kim Lane Chapelet.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Kim Lane Chapelet, who's a professor of sociology and international affairs in the Woodrow Wilson School and the University Center for Human Values, as well as director of the program in law and public affairs at Princeton University. From 1994 to 1998, she lived in Budapest, doing research at the Constitutional Court of Hungary and teaching at both the University of Budapest and at Central European University, where she was a founding director of the program in gender and culture. After 1989, Chapelet studied the emergence of constitutional law in Hungary and Russia, living in both places for extended periods. Her latest book is The International State of Emergency, The Rise of Global Security Law. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.